You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. Joining you, as always, is my colleague, Joe Healy. And we are here. It is the 13th of July as we record this. Just a few days before the start of the Major League Baseball draft, we're going to get into some draft preview here on the podcast. We're going to talk about Joe's list of the top 50 transfers in college baseball this summer. And we've got some college baseball news from around the country to get to as well. And Millie, as always, has some thoughts already, as you can hear. So we've got a lot to get to here on the podcast today. And I will say, before we really dive into any of this, that if you are looking for draft information, like Joe and I are going to look at the draft from a college baseball perspective today. But if you're looking to really dive in, you absolutely can do that at Baseball America. The BA 500, the list of the 500 best draft prospects in the 2022 draft is up. There are scouting reports for all 500 players. I would encourage you to dive into that. If you start reading that by the time you stop listening to this show, maybe by the time the draft starts on Sunday, you'll be through number 450 or something. It is very extensive. There are a lot of them. Carlos and the team put a lot of effort into that. So if you're looking to find out about the players, that is absolutely the best way to do it. There's plenty of other draft-related content that you can read to get yourself up to speed or to dive in on this draft class. So I'd encourage you to seek that out if that's what you're after. If you're after more of a surface level, how this affects college baseball kind of thing, Joe and I are here to help you with that today and talk about some other things as well. So a lot to get to on today's edition of the Baseball America College Podcast, Joe.
I like that was a little bit of a manager expectations kind of warning at the beginning for like the draft, because like it's just different. Like, it's not that we're uninformed, it's just a different standpoint on it. So like, it is good to manage expectations of, we're not really here to like chop it up on, you know, which arm is going to, you know, they're going to reach for and shouldn't, or, you know, what we're hearing about, you know, who's moving up and down. Like, Carlos has that covered really well. There are others, you know, who on staff who are doing a good job of that kind of thing. That is not what this will be.
Yeah. I am not here to tell you who the Orioles are selecting, nor who they should select.
Right. But you know,
maybe it isn't, like, I don't know. But no, I'm not here to do that.
I am definitely not. They should probably just they should pick the guy who's going to be a Hall of Famer, whoever that is. I don't know who it is, but that's what they should do.
Cal Ripken Jr. Here, he's right. Pretty good.
Yeah. They would also take like a, well, this is actually funny. I was going to use the example of BJ Surhoff, but he actually was a first overall pick, wasn't he?
I believe that's right? Correct. Yes.
In the 80s. Yeah. That is an interesting thing. Side note. This is just a total side note. Like, I think this is true in all sports. Maybe the NBA has like a higher hit rate in general, I mean, baseball is the lowest hit rate because you have to traverse the minor leagues. There's just a whole lot more friction to getting to stardom. But, you know, teams look at the first overall pick and think like future star, anything but multiple all-star games and borderline Hall of Fame case is probably like a little bit disappointing, when the reality is like, you should really just be hoping for like a good solid regular. That's kind of just true early in the draft generally, but people always expect, we've talked about this before, I think, or Carlos has talked about this before, where it's like, where player comps are kind of tricky is that everyone wants to hear that the player that you're comping for is like an all-star type player, but like some player in the big leagues has to be just an average player. So like, you know, you comp players to guys who are just like meh, and people think that means he's bad, but really it's just that not every player is going to turn into a perennial all-star. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. But what I was going to say on a larger point is it does feel like that for a number of different reasons, which I'm sure we've covered extensively on previous podcasts through the last several years, but the draft does seem a little more pertinent to college baseball. Newsy in college baseball is maybe the better way to put it. You know, in the old 40-round draft, maybe it was just that they'd done that for so long. I mean, it used to be longer, obviously, but with that big draft, you kind of understood the game. You know, also there was a time when players weren't choosing college at quite such a high rate. Now with a shorter draft, more players choosing the college route for a variety of reasons, it does kind of feel like the draft is a little more of a news item from a college baseball standpoint, where I can remember as recently as, you know, just 5 to 7 years ago, there might be one or two teams that are notable on the high or low end. Either they lost more than they thought they were going to lose, or they're going to get back more than they thought they were going to get back. There were a couple of those, but most years kind of went exactly as you would expect. There's a little more movement, it feels like, now in the draft. So if you're just a college baseball fan, there is a little more to watch and to kind of game out than there used to be in the draft. And that's based on just my hunch here, but that's kind of my feeling of where we are in the draft. So if you're just a college baseball fan, there is a reason beyond just seeing players from your team get drafted. There is a little more to watch at play here.
I am interested. That's an interesting thing to note. And I think that's generally true, but I think that's been especially true the last 2 years. And I'll be interested to see if it's true again this year. In 2020, it was obviously that way because they only had 5 rounds. So like any player that got drafted, they all signed, and you know, we kind of knew that was going to be the case going into it, that with only 5 rounds in the draft, you couldn't afford to take any risks. You had to know. And with only 5 rounds, there were going to be a lot of players coming back to college or entering college that ordinarily wouldn't. And then last year, they took a long time to decide that it was only going to be 20 rounds. And there are all these excess players because there had only been this 5-round draft. And how is that going to work itself out and all the rest of that? Well, now this year, it's been known to be a 20-round draft for much longer. Although, again, it did take a little while to get there because of the CBA negotiations. There are still excess players in some respects. In other respects, those are starting to clear through. Just how is this all going to work in this new system? So I think that is one of the interesting aspects of it is, are they, you know, have any of the various tweaks or just the more experience with the 20-round draft, has that gotten us more to a place where it was before, where there would be less or more surprises or less surprise, you know, whatever. I will be interested to see how that shakes out this year. But regardless, I think you're right, Joe, that the draft just has taken on a larger meaning with as more players have chosen college, either coming back to college, you know, as a draft eligible player coming back. And that's especially true right now with players still having that extra year of eligibility due to the canceled 2020 season, or just high school players choosing to develop in college baseball. And of course, we think that's only going to become more prevalent with the shrunk version of the minor leagues. We saw that for the first time last year, but again, last year was a little bit of a different draft. We'll see again how true that is this year. Starting this weekend, the draft, some pertinent information on, I guess, the draft is that it starts on Sunday with the first 2 rounds. I think they're going 80 picks between the first two rounds and the comp rounds. And there's an extra pick in there for something. Anyway, I'm pretty sure it's 80 picks on the first night. As they go two rounds plus, and then they come back on Monday with the rest of the top 10 rounds. And then on Tuesday with 11 through 20, you can watch the first day of the draft on MLB Network, and you can watch Carlos Collazo as a part of the broadcast. So that is where we are advising you to watch the draft. Obviously, you can also watch on ESPN, but check out MLB Network because you can see our Carlos Collazo as part of that broadcast.
I guess and hair made for TV.
You know, definitely better than you and me in that department.
No doubt. Carlos, very telegenic. I get that feedback from him all the time. Like I'll be, Carlos no longer lives in the Carolinas, much like Teddy has moved out in recent years, but, you know, spent a lot of time in this area. So the scouts here know him well. I mean, most scouts do just cause he talks to a lot of them. They see him on TV, yada, yada, yada. But, I remember when I first moved here and, like I'd introduce myself to scouts in the scouting section. They'd hear that I was from BA and they would, you know, invariably make some comment about Carlos. And oftentimes it was based around like good head of hair that kid has, you know, that was always the, that was often the feedback I got, but, plays well on TV as maybe a scout would say, it plays well.
Plays up.
Yeah, no doubt.
Okay. So, you know, again, we're not here to talk about who the Orioles are taking at one or any of the rest of, you know, those kinds of things. So there are some interesting college storylines within the draft. One of which I guess is not who is going to be the first college player taken, because it seems like everyone is expecting at this point that to be Brooks Lee from Cal Poly, though Kevin Parada, maybe Gavin Cross, you certainly have a chance to get in there depending on how the draft works out. Maybe a better question, though, is who's going to be the first college pitcher taken, because there were, I don't know if you heard this, Joe, I feel like not enough people were talking about it. There were a lot of pitching injuries this year to top arms. Did you hear anything about that this year?
I heard like a whisper of it. It was very like very hush hush. But yeah, it wasn't probably an underreported story, frankly. But yeah, it's that. I mean, that's even for someone like me who's very, I mean, I guess I can't say I'm ignorant on the draft because like I'm privy to our conversations in Slack at a bare minimum. But even someone like me who is very much more of a normie about the draft than, you know, than some other, like than Carlos certainly, and even some others on staff, because I just don't, frankly, because I don't know the high school draft class as well as others. But like, yeah, that, I mean, that even for someone like me, like that is very much front of mind about what, how it shakes out. And I'll be fascinated to see what, you know, not just who the first guy is, but how do teams approach it? Do they reach for college pitchers just because it's like, well, we need a, you know, traditionally college pitchers are a pretty fruitful well to pull from. So do we reach for the guys who are actually healthy? Do we just pretend like the guys we liked before the season that got hurt? Do we just kind of pretend like they didn't get hurt and draft where we think they should be drafted? I mean, there's really everything. Or do we just not bother this year and just punt it and just pick out position players or high school arms or whatever it is and punt it to next year? I think there's just really no shortage of ways a team could go. And I think we're going to see all kinds.
I mean, on the BA 500 right now, and I think by the time you listen to this, Carlos, it will have tweaked the list is my understanding, but it's just a tweak. So I don't really anticipate what I'm about to say changing. Right now, the top-ranked college pitcher, Joe, I'm going to guess that you don't know precisely. So where do you think the top-ranked college pitcher is ranked on the 500?
Okay, on the 500, okay. 21.
It is 22, and that's Gabriel Hughes of Gonzaga. Now, it could be, however, so like that's the truest answer. But Zach Neto's 16, and he's pitched. And Chase DeLauder is 19. Yeah. And he's pitched too. So, you know, like those are going to be the first college pitchers taken is probably Zach Neto. But the actual, like will be drafted as a pitcher is Gabriel Hughes, 22. And Kamar Rocker is 20 and he's not a college pitcher. Like we are classifying him as other because he did not play college this year. He played independent league baseball. So that's not how we'll classify it. But if you want to think of Kamar as a college pitcher still, that's fine. He's 20. And then it's Hughes at 22 and Cade Horton at 23. And what a remarkable rise that has been, because a month ago, I'm not even sure he was on the 500. So this is the college pitching class. So who's going to be the first is, you know, like if you draft off of the 500, it would be Hughes. But that's not to say that somebody doesn't like, you know, some team doesn't like Jerpy more or, you know, Horton more or Wisenhunt more. Wisenhunt is he a college pitcher? Is he not? You know, he didn't pitch this year either, but is technically a college pitcher. Blade Tidwell, like it's, you're going to have to wait a while to hear a college pitcher's name called is the point. And, you know, we definitely talked throughout the spring about how many injuries there were to guys like Landon Sims and Prelip, of course, got hurt last year and didn't come back, and Wisenhunt, who got suspended, and Tidwell didn't start the season, and you know how he missed the first 6 weeks of the year, and it's just been a messy year, and you know that's definitely going to be very apparent on Sunday when you know you're going to be waiting a long time to hear a pitcher's name called, whether we're talking about high school or college, but especially college.
Yeah, it's going to be a with no real consensus about how to approach not just the individual best college pitchers on the board, but how to approach that entire subset of players. Like it really is going to be a Rorschach test for what you want to do. Because I do think there are going to be some teams that are just going to shy away. I do think there are some teams that are just going to lean heavily on, you know, hey, how much did our scouts see Cade Horton late in the year, you know, and how much do you believe in that, you know, and taking some risks. And you know, when there's a consensus, it's easy. You know, it's just, you know, that the industry, as they would say, kind of just agrees on this small handful of guys. And it's just a matter of who's up first in the pecking order. But this year is going to be different. You know, you mentioned that the top two guys in the 500, you know, pitcher wise, it was Hughes and who was second?
Horton.
Okay, well, I thought there was one between those two. Do I have that wrong?
No, Hughes is 22. Horton's 23. Rocker's 20.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. And so like Hughes in particular is an interesting one. Thomas Harrington's a little bit like this at Campbell, where those are the kind of the guys I'm talking about where it's like, don't be wrong, they were high end prospects to begin the season, but just by virtue of kind of being healthy and by, you know, the industry kind of looking around and being like, well, I guess these are the healthy guys. Like their stock has risen. Like, so you could see those guys come off first because it's like, okay, these are healthy, long track record, relatively speaking. Performed this year, all that kind of stuff. You could see Cade Horton, which is like, if Cade Horton comes back as Oklahoma's Friday guy next year, for example, we know he's in all likelihood not going to do that. But if he were to do that, you could project him to be like, hey, this is like maybe a 1-1 kind of guy. So you could fall in love with that. You know, you could take, you know, the Rocker because like, well, that actually is track record. And you know, if you're not concerned about the medical piece of it. So, it really is just going to be like, what do you value here? How are you evaluating, this injured class? And I, you know, I don't even think, you know, we've talked so much about what we don't know versus what someone like Carlos knows or what even the industry knows. And I think the answer is that we just don't know. And I think we're going to get a lot of one-off situations come Sunday and Monday.
Yeah. I mean, there is no one way to approach this because, you know, in Cade Horton, you know, and I feel like I've probably talked about this on other podcasts that, you know, there's a player who has thrown less than 50 innings in college baseball, was a massive prospect, like very, very famous coming out of high school. So nobody is going to be lacking on track record, but you only saw him pitch like 50 innings in college baseball. And he knows that if he returns to school, and bets on himself, he has a chance to go in the top 10 picks next year if he proves it that he can do this over a full season. You know, you're talking about a guy that would contend to be the first overall pick, certainly. So, like, are you willing, how the game of chicken there between, like, what are you willing to pay him now? What does he want? Where do you meet in the middle? Like, all of that is potentially fascinating. I mean, you have a guy like Rocker who has the longest track record of any of these pitchers, but, you know, obviously what happened last year with his medical situation is a thing, and that continues to be a thing that is discussed. And then you have like Landon Sims, who was incredible as a multi-inning fireman a year ago, helping Mississippi State win the national championship, started this year really well as a starter, but you only got like four starts out of him to see what that looked like as a starter. And, you know, so where do you land on that? And, you know, Prelip, I think, never pitched an SEC inning because he was electric in the first four starts in 2020, and then the season was canceled. And then in 2021, he started very well, and then he got injured before the SEC play began. Like, I mean, that's what you're dealing with here in terms of track records with those guys. And yeah, there's so many different variables that everyone you're going to, the teams are not just going to be able to say like, oh, look at all these Tommy John guys that had Tommy John surgery. Like that, it's not just that simple to say, here's that group of players and who do we like best out of that. Like there are a lot of things to parse within that. And so the pitching aspect of this draft is going to be quite, quite interesting and quite the storyline to follow on Sunday night. As big as Sunday night is, you know, for the industry and for college baseball, is, you know, you'll see stars like Jacob Melton and Cooper Jerpy and, you know, Drew Gilbert and Jacob Berry. You'll see those guys move into pro baseball, and that will be very exciting for them and their families and all the rest of that. One of the biggest items for college baseball, though, is going to be what happens day two and day three. Who says no to professional baseball for the year, and who either comes back to college or who decides from a high school to junior college level that they are going to go to college and put off professional baseball for however many years that going to college means for them. And we saw this have a massive impact on this year's season. It has an impact on every season, but it had a massive impact this year. Think about what Ivan Melendez meant to Texas. That's the player of the year this year, who is a pick in the teens last year by the Marlins. He chooses not to sign. He comes back to Texas and he hits 32 home runs. Like that's obviously the most extreme example you can look at, but you know, Tim Elko, Chris Aline at Maryland, like those guys had chances, whether it was at the back of the draft or as a free agent signing, they could have gone. Instead, they come back. They have these incredible seasons. They help their teams, two incredible seasons. And in Elko's case, a national championship. So who this year is going to make such a move is going to be one of the things that is most impactful on college baseball. And Joe and I are not going to sit here and necessarily like predict this, because I don't think that we could have necessarily predicted that Ivan Melendez was going to come back a year ago, but it is something that I think everyone is going to be very carefully watching. And whether it's a high school player coming to college, like a Peyton Stovall or Davis Diaz, like these guys have real impact. But the biggest impact, I think, is the juniors or seniors, third or fourth year players who say no to professional baseball. I want to come back and play one more season of college baseball, who, you know, have these outsized impacts on the following season.
I think that's right. It's like the trope, you know, the NFL draft and the NHL draft, which I watched a couple days ago. Let's go Blues. They say, like, you know, round one is where you get your cornerstones, your franchise players, but like rounds, you know, certainly 2 through 7, but really, you know, 5 through 7 are kind of where, if you can find serviceable players, that's how you kind of build out your team. Similarly, to your point, like those later rounds, like the 11 through 20 rounds, are really where you get those swing situations where, you know, a kid has a decision to make. You know, now with NIL money, not that the money is huge in college baseball, we know that. We're not going to turn this into an NIL podcast, but, you know, certainly in the SEC, there are opportunities for kids to come back and not have to sign for just whatever and come back and play in the SEC or whatever major conference and maybe make a little money on the side, whatever it is. That's where kind of you see those swing situations. Melendez is a great example. I mean, that's, you know, and he was kind of existing in a world before a lot of that stuff, but you know, he's drafted in the 16th round and thought he had something to prove, and it turned Texas into, I mean, Texas flatly, especially dealing with some of the stuff they dealt with, the Tanner Witt injury, Tristan Stevens not quite being Tristan Stevens, like all that stuff. Like they probably don't survive all that, almost certainly do not survive all that and get to Omaha without Melendez being what he was, even if he's the Melendez he was in 2021, which is a very good player. Like they probably aren't what they are without that kind of turnaround. And it's hard to predict. You just never know. Like this happens every year where I'm watching the MLB.com broadcast of rounds, you know, even really the top 10 rounds, you'll hear a name get popped and you're like, oh, that was not a name I expected to hear this early. And suddenly you're like, okay, well, that probably actually changes the calculus for this team. Conversely, you know, this starts to be a talking point towards the end of day two, is you can really start to do the accounting of what names have we not heard. I famously, this was a weird draft, obviously, but famously, you know, Florida in 2020, when you didn't hear Leftwich and Mace's name and you were like, I guess they're just not, this is just isn't going to happen. I guess they're coming back. You know, you can really start to do the accounting of that as we move on. And it's hard to know. I mean, Teddy and I could sit here and look over the BA 500 and like really find out who these guys are, because once you get into the late 300s and into the 400s, now you're talking the territory we're kind of talking about for tweeners. And you know, Texas could be one of those teams again. Like, I don't think these guys are like Ivan Melendez level turnaround guys, but guys like Doug Hodo or Eric Kennedy, like, do they certainly have tools? Do they go, do they come back? Oklahoma State's an interesting team to kind of stick in the Big 12. Does Victor Medeiros, who has good stuff, but hasn't quite put it either at Miami or in this past year at Oklahoma State, like
he's a sophomore, and those right, guys traditionally have, you know, you're giving up less leverage.
Right. Has, you know, some leverage to come back. Could he be like a real dude on Fridays? Like, he's a guy who stands out to me as could be an Ivan Melendez level guy, where blue chip recruit who just hasn't quite put it together at the college level, does one more year make the difference? But even beyond that, Roman Fanselker came on really strong late. He could come back. Caden Trinkle, an outfielder with some tools. You could even maybe talk yourself into Trevor Martin as like, what if Oklahoma State brings him back and starts him?
I mean, Nolan McLean is only a sophomore as well. And I think that was a late development. And also, like, what is he? Is he a hitter? Is he a pitcher? Does he prefer doing one thing? You know, what does professional baseball want him as? Probably a pitcher. Like, you know, all of these things play into that with McLean.
Yeah. So that's a team that really of the quick look I did, like, that's the team actually, I think, that stands out the most to me, is just having a lot of tweeners that could go one way or the other. And these things do tend to kind of play on themselves, right? I mean, if all those guys get drafted, you know, between rounds 8 and 20, and a couple of them very publicly and very quickly come back, like, that does make it a little more tempting for those other guys to come back. Meanwhile, the inverse can also be true. If some of those guys sign real quick, it can kind of feel like, okay, well, you know, this is clearly the end of an era. Let's just move on. So those things can kind of build on themselves, but we part of the beauty of it, though, is that we won't really know what teams we're talking about until it actually starts to unfold on obviously not Sunday so much, but late Monday and then into Tuesday.
I think that's definitely true. We will not know this on Sunday, but also, you know, just because you get one of these guys back doesn't mean everything works out in your favor. Like, I'm now looking at Vanderbilt, and I think they have some guys that it could fall into that situation this year. But also, we saw it happen to them last year. They got Dominic Keegan back, and like, look, that was a really big deal for Vanderbilt. But it didn't quite gel at Vanderbilt the way you would have expected this year. But I think generally that first baseman trope might be something to watch. We saw several of those players not sign last year. And then, you know, you look around and in Omaha, you had Tim Elko, you had Ivan Melendez, you had Sonny DeShera, who doesn't really fit the same level, but like, just, you had these big first baseman slugger types who have an outsized impact in college baseball, but maybe, you know, no, first basemen are not something that the draft values right now. And I think about what we're seeing in college basketball with traditional centers choosing to return because the NBA doesn't value traditional centers in the same way that college basketball does. And what, you know, the you know, that if you follow college basketball, you know that, you know, Oscar Tshiebwe, the Kentucky center, the player of the year, is coming back to college this year. And like, that's a massive deal and very strange, just in that you have a returning national player of the year type in college basketball. And I wonder, like, I don't think it will be as impactful as it is in basketball, because, you know, we're talking about baseball, where one player doesn't mean as much as they do in hoops. But I have been thinking about that for like almost a month now, and I'm very interested to see if it happens again this year. And if that is something then moving forward that colleges can kind of count on, that like, if you have a first baseman slugger type, that maybe you have a better chance to bring him back to school, because maybe MLB won't value him in the same way that you and your style of play does. So these are things to watch as the draft unfolds this week. Anything else you want to touch on here, Joe?
No, I think that's it. I mean, I think you're onto something there with that. I mean, you also, we'll talk about the transfer portal a little later, but I think you can also see that expressed in the transfer portal by the types of players who end up getting opportunities at high-end SEC or ACC or what have you, those types of schools, because they tend to be certain archetypes of players that get passed over in the draft. So they're in a position to have a play, need to go play somewhere. They put up numbers. I mean, Sonny DeShare is a great example that you mentioned, but there are a lot of guys like this year, as I was doing transfer coverage, where they're putting up a bunch of numbers, and like, yes, they're at mid-major schools, and so that you always cast a doubtful eye on that, but it's kind of the same archetype of players who is ending up going to play at, you know, Auburn or Mississippi State, you know, RJ Yeager at Mississippi State, another good example. And then those guys tend to, for the most part, I'd actually like to go back to last year's transfer list and really do a full accounting of this, but it feels like those are the types of players that they tend to have a pretty big hit rate as they transfer up. And so I think that's true in the draft. I think it's true, you know, in terms of transfers, that there's just certain archetypes of players that don't get valued in such a way that puts them in position to be recruited necessarily by the high-end programs, which obviously puts them on a path to being drafted higher, or once they're in school to being drafted. So I think that's it's just kind of a really interesting thing that hopefully you or us or whoever has time to actually dive into at some point. Cause I think there is a there, but you know, just can't say exactly how much of a there is there.
One more thing before we move on here is you mentioned transfers, is that this year you are also seeing this group of player who is in the portal, maybe has committed to a place, but is an obvious draft risk and is either using the portal like as a clear like leverage play, maybe not, like that makes it sound like very sinister, and like that they're using these schools as, you know, they're just using these schools to get more money out of pro teams. But like, I don't think in a lot of cases they mean it like quite like that. But you know, you look at it and you're like, are you sure you're not just gonna sign? Like, but I like, because this is kind of the first shot that we've had at these kinds of players, you know, going through this process, I will be interested to see how pro baseball treats them and how they treat it and all the rest of it. And top of mind is Reggie Crawford, who is leaving UConn and committed to Tennessee this week, but also right now is graded out in the BA 500 as a second round pick. And, you know, obviously he, like Cade Horton, has incredible upside if he were to stay healthy. You know, he had Tommy John surgery in the fall. If he had like a full healthy season next year, like what would his draft potential be? You know, it's a very reasonable question to ask. So does he now that he's committed to Tennessee, is he harder to sign? Does that not matter? I don't know. I'll be interested to see, you know, a player like him, Jordan Sprinkle going from UCSB, he's committed to Arkansas now. Like, what does that mean? Right now I would project that those guys sign, but who knows? And that is kind of one of the from a college baseball perspective, players like that are a big open question right now.
Yeah. And those guys are hard to, through no fault of their own necessarily, those guys are kind of hard to figure. I mean, Reggie Crawford, by the way, we didn't touch on him a ton when we talked about pitcher injuries, but you want to talk about mystery of all mysteries.
That's been my stock answer. Oh, you mean UConn's first baseman? Because he threw like 4 innings in college or something.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're close. Yeah, it was eight total innings. Struck out 17 in those 8 innings and like was electric for Team USA the previous, you know, last summer. But like, man, you want to talk about just having to go all in on someone's potential, because like that potential is immense, but you want to talk about track record, like there's just not much there. And so even like, I mean, the hitting track record is there, like he showed good power, you know, UConn, you could nitpick like, you know, contact rate and all that stuff, but like the dude can hit. So like, even if he ends up at Tennessee, it's like, what are they going to get from him on the mound? Like the stuff is incredible. Like I got nothing but raves about the stuff when I was writing up the prospect list for the collegiate national team last summer, but like, you know, you really, can he get SEC hitters out consistently? Like with the stuff, I'd be confident the answer is yes, but like, we really don't know. Like how do you even evaluate that? Like that is a fascinating piece of information that we will learn a little bit about as time goes on. Cause the other thing about it is too, is like Tennessee's rotation is set, and like UConn was going to run him out as a starter. That's my understanding, at least. I mean, we never know how it would have played out, but he never got that chance. But Tennessee's rotation is set. So like, is he going to Tennessee to be a closer, to fight for a rotation spot? Like, I know I'm sure there'll be competition.
Starter is a possibility, I suppose. And maybe that would be better to that. He starts on Tuesday and hits all weekend. Like most teams with like viable two-way players don't have that luxury. Tennessee has that luxury.
Yeah, that's a good point. So anyway, that's just like layers on layers for what's already kind of a complicated situation. But anyway, we didn't touch on earlier. And so, yeah, I'm glad that you circled back on him, just because he's among the most fascinating players in the entire draft, as far as I'm concerned.
No doubt about that. All right. So I wish we could just like straight transition from you use that as the perfect spin point from this draft preview into Joe's transfer list. But alas, we have to get a commercial in here. So we're going to do that here in a second. And then we'll be back to talk top 50 transfers and some college baseball news. So first, check this out.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't a search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. That's why I use Indeed for our hiring at Baseball America. It allows me to do everything on one website. I get quality candidates. I can schedule them. I can interview them. I can screen them. I can send messages to them, all within Indeed. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Baseball America. Just go to Indeed.com/Baseball America right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Baseball America. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
All right, let's go to the transfer list, Joe. And this is something we started, I guess, last year with the introduction of the transfer portal and the removal of the rule requiring players to sit a year before they are eligible to play after transferring. We now are tracking the top impact transfers every summer We start with the top 50 list. Eventually it grows into 100, and you know, we'll see what else you produce out of this stuff this year. But minimally, we've got a top 50 list to talk about now. And the rules of this are that you have to already be committed to land on this list. So, for example, Paul Skeens, who is transferring from Air Force, who is an All-American, is not on this list yet because he has not announced where he is going to play next year. So got to be committed to make the list. Any other rules, Joe? Is that basically the only rule we've got?
Yeah, that's basically the first rule of Fight Club, which everyone knows is be yourself and have fun. It's the first rule of Fight Club. But you know, it's, yeah. So
sometimes be Brad Pitt, sometimes be, what's his name? That other guy.
Yeah, that other guy. Like, confession, I've actually never seen Fight Club.
Really? Well, I came very close to spoiling something for you there. And fortunately, I can't remember the other guy's name. So
well,
you, right. You know nothing now. And that's okay.
Yeah. I just know it's kind of a meme out there sometimes that people say the first rule of Fight Club is to be yourself and have fun.
It's because the actual first rule of Fight Club is to never talk about Fight Club.
Right. Right. I do know that. I do know that was definitely a thing. Is that Edward Norton? Is that the other guy?
That's correct. That's correct. Yes.
All right. For a guy who's never seen it, look at me go. Okay. So
Edward Norton, in the transfer portal.
He is not. No. He's probably doesn't have any eligibility left. Yeah. The only real rule is that you're committed. And like, basically I just do that to kind of avoid having to make judgment calls on when to include players. So sorry, you didn't quite make the cut. Matt Woods from Bryant, the NEC player of the year, committed to Maryland today. So
like, there's also, I would say part of the reason we did that last year was because you can go in the portal and just come back. And at which point you haven't really transferred and, you know, why are we including you on a list like Jacob Wilson from Grand Canyon did? Like, he went in the portal because there was a lot of uncertainty, and ultimately Andy Stankiewicz left Grand Canyon. And then when they hired Greg Wallace, or just promoted Greg Wallace, although he did briefly officially work for Ohio State, Jacob Wilson decided to return. You know, so we are also avoiding that situation, I think.
That's correct. I hope Greg Wallace didn't sign anything when he was in Columbus.
Like, you mean?
Yeah. Like, man, talk about just, I mean, if it's a good situation. Like, obviously he goes back in that situation, everyone understands that, but it's like, man, you want to talk about like a stressful situation that you did not need, like trying to wiggle your way out of a lease that you just signed in Columbus, Ohio. Yeah. I mean, so yes, you're right. That is also to avoid a situation like that. I mean, you also get a lot of stuff now. You get a lot of guys going to the portal, just kind of, Jacob Wilson was an example, but you know, not everybody in this group, or most of this group, would have qualified for this list. But you know, Tulane had, like, you know, more than a dozen players in the transfer portal when Travis Jewett was fired.
The entirety of the Arizona roster entered the portal last year when Jay Johnson left because of the timing. It was like, well, either you get in the portal now or you're stuck.
Right. So there is some of that as well. So like, yeah, we would have, you know, maybe written up, you know, some T.O. Banks. I don't know if he would have, probably wouldn't have been in the 50, but like might have been in the 100, like decides to go back to Tulane. Like, okay. Regardless. Yes. Yeah. So you just have to be committed. And yes, this list will move to 100. So like while we are calling this the best 50 transfers in college baseball, it is possible that, you know, whoever's number, you know, like Paul Skeens will slot in somewhere in the top five. And so whoever's in the top five now won't be in that same spot. So it is a living document, if you will. So we're not just bolting on 100, you know, 51 to 100. It's that we're re-ranking once we get more players to commit. So,
and Reggie Crawford is on this list, and as we mentioned, he may well sign,
right?
So he would then leave the list.
Correct. Yeah. So it is a living document. It is not just an expansion of the, it's not like the, you know, the, well, I guess the BA 500 is a little bit like this too, but I know that Carlos goes from 200 to 300 to 500 at various points. And that's a little more of just like adding depth to the list. This is kind of a re-rank. So, regardless, just a couple quick headlines from it. One is just the inescapable LSU of it all. I think it's six of the top 25 players committed to LSU. That's what
the people tell me.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure. I did not know that. I mean, I knew there were a lot, but I didn't quite know the extent of it until I saw that tweet. So Yeah, six of the top 25. There are some interesting guys in there too. I mean, there are some sure things, right? Tommy White, like, okay, duh. He's the number one player on this list. Spoiler alert. But, you know, they've got guys like Carter Young and Jack Pineda who could get drafted. Like, there are some questions there. So they do have some unanswerables. But for the most part, between White and Thatcher Hurd, if he's healthy, you know, Christian Little is going to play a role. Depends on, you know, we don't know what that role is exactly just yet. But, I mean, they've done some big time shopping in the portal. And I wrote about this during Omaha. I mean, look, all you have to do is look at what A&M did to see that, you know, and LSU was not in the dire a situation, obviously. I mean, that was a regional team this year. They are not in the situation that A&M was in. But what they did show is that, like, you know, chemistry be damned. And there was no evidence that it was a bad chemistry situation. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that's the big reason why some coaches might have been against building a roster this way, is how do you mix that roster together? But A&M showed that, like, you can do it. You can figure it out. And so, you know, LSU, to their credit, just kind of saying, yeah, why not? Let's do this. And so, like, they are, there's really no way around that being the big, whether you want to just say that, look at it, that's the Tommy White, because he is the, this era of transfers, he is the best player who has transferred. I think I'd take him over Jacob Berry, although that's a debate.
That's a very reasonable debate to have.
Yeah.
And also, once Paul Skeens commits, I mean, like, we can debate on where exactly he lands, but if he intends to play two ways at his new school, like, there is an argument to be made, I think, for him.
Yeah, fair enough. You know what? I guess I'm discounting Berry a little bit because his move was a little bit telegraphed, right? So it's like, Tommy White is the best player we've had who it's like, holy crap, Tommy White is in the portal, you know? Jacob Berry going to LSU following Jay Johnson, it was kind of like, okay, you know, we get that. Frankly, it was like more of a surprise, and every player has their reasons, but it was more a surprise, like, oh, Daniel Susak is going to stay at Arizona, you know? Especially when you consider that LSU needed a catcher
going into last season. I remember because Susak initially was committed to Oregon State, decommitted and committed to Arizona when Nate Yeske went from Oregon State to Arizona. And so I just assumed that, like, either he's going to A&M or LSU now. And instead he stayed at Arizona. And my understanding is some of that was just like, well, he knew he was a draft eligible sophomore, so was it worth uprooting for one season? Now, Jacob Berry looked at a similar decision as a draft eligible sophomore and said yes. Daniel Susak came to a different conclusion. Here's the thing. And I feel like this, I don't want to make this into a, like, transfers are good or bad or what, like, I don't want to have that discussion. We should just talk about the players that are transferring. But most students, I feel like, do not want to transfer. Like, they pick a school for a reason, and, you know, they evaluate different situations differently, or the same situations differently. Two players, Jacob Berry, Daniel Susak, both looking at being first round picks after draft eligible sophomore seasons, saw the same situation and came to two different conclusions.
Right. And it's also important, I think, you know, I was going to say this a little bit later when we start talking about maybe some individual cases, but players also have a lot of different reasons for transferring or not transferring. Now, there are some obvious ones, right? You're crushing it in a mid-major and you want to prove yourself in the SEC. Got it. You know, I was a highly ranked recruit that hasn't quite been able to cut it in my SEC program. I want to find somewhere where I'm going to be able to get a little more playing time or just be a little in a less high pressure situation. Got it. You know, there are a number of others. NIL money. I got NIL money. Great. Good for you. Got it. But there are a lot of, like, one-off cases. I'm staying because I have a girlfriend here. You know, I'm staying here because I have a lot of friends here. I'm staying here because the academics make sense for me. You know, you even, as much as we roll our eyes at this stuff, and you don't really see this on the high end, but there definitely also are cases where I don't necessarily want to transfer, but if I'm going to play a fifth year of college baseball, where I'm at now does not have either A, have a grad school at all, or B, does not offer the graduate program that I want to be in.
Or like, it's really hard to get into Stanford's grad school. Like, Jacob Palish was relatively open about that this year, that, like, he left Stanford because he graduated, and, like, it's really hard to get into Stanford grad school. And, you know, it's just, it's not for everyone, you know? So the list here, as it stands, Joe mentioned Tommy White at number one. is going from NC State to LSU, and Hurston Waldrop going from Southern Miss to Florida. Those two guys were both All-Americans this year. Those are your 1-2. And, you know, I don't think there's any real like ambiguity about those guys. I feel like college baseball has a pretty good idea of who they are, especially Tommy Tanks. You know, with what he did this year, setting the freshman record for home runs with 27, despite not even having a postseason, I suppose it should be said. And, you know, Waldrop was exceptional there for Southern Miss in their outstanding rotation. So those two guys pretty well known. Maui Yohuna going from Kansas to Tennessee, and Thatcher Hurd, UCLA to LSU, two relatively prominent recruits. I think here, when we get to number five, though, we start maybe getting to players who are a little less well known. And Luke Kuechel checks in here at five, San Francisco to Arizona State. He's a guy that was really good on the Cape Cod League a year ago. That was kind of his breakout situation. He'd been really good in the Cal Ripken League earlier in the summer and then got called up to the Cape for the second half and continued to hit really well there. He's just a hitter, period. And Arizona State, I mean, we've talked about LSU, and maybe we'll can talk even more about what LSU has done in the portal. But just in terms of other schools outside the SEC, because a lot of SEC schools are doing well in the portal, Arizona State went heavy in the portal this year, and Luke Kuechel's one of the bigger prizes to come out of that, as is Ross Dunn, who goes from Florida State to Arizona State.
Yeah, the schools that really did a lot of heavy lifting here are kind of a grab bag, and in most cases, you kind of understand it. You know, LSU, obviously, it's because they are just in pursuit of the absolute best. And every team does this, right? But like, they are just in dogged pursuit of like the best 35 guys they can put on the 35 man roster, right? And so like, they're going to do that all over the place. And they can do that because kids want to play at LSU, and there's just opportunity there. And maybe you throw in a little NIL money, whatever it is. That's where they're coming at from there. Arizona State, down year in 2022, like clearly a roster that needs to get a little bit of a jolt. Like Willie Bloomquist actually kind of inherited a relatively old roster that kind of had a lot of guys on it who have been around a while that maybe have like some struggles in their past, like on the field. I mean, that sounded like more sinister than I meant it to be, like some personal struggles. No, just like struggles on the field.
A lot of, you know, personal divorces that they've gone through.
And, yeah.
You know, they just really, really some tough job situations that they're dealing right. with. And
yes.
Some tough moves.
Yeah, that's right. But no, just like struggles in the field, injuries, like it's kind of an older roster that kind of, you know, hasn't all come together. Right. So it feels like they're kind of just trying to overhaul things there. So that one makes a little sense. Kentucky is playing big in the portal again. That's clearly at this point, just kind of like a strategy that Nick Mangione and his staff are employing there. South Carolina is kind of in a similar situation. Like they're clearly just going to be playing a lot in the portal now. That's also a situation where
South Carolina is a cross between Kentucky and Arizona State, and that they're trying to get better.
For sure. South Carolina knows that 2023 has to be better, like period, end of story. And so like, yes, you're right. That is another one that's kind of a surprise though, when you talk about on the program level is Texas A&M's at it again. And like, it's good players. So it's not like, you know, I'm looking at it and casting it aside for that reason, or casting a side glance at it for that reason. It's that I just didn't expect them to do this a second year. Now, I guess some of it maybe is precipitated by the fact that, like, yes, you had some grad transfers, Dylan Rock and Cole Kaler and Troy Klaunch. And so those guys those spots have to get filled. But I just kind of thought that they would be in a more traditional recruiting situation now after that first year, especially after they had the success of it in the portal in the first year. Although I guess you could also look at that as a reason to do it again, but
yeah, I think that is the situation here, that I think they intended to do it more high school, but they saw what worked this year and why not try it again?
Yeah. So, I mean, those are kind of the schools, and we'll see some other schools, you know, that there's some schools kind of in the middle, like that, I mean, those are really the schools that are like really taking on a high number. You know, Tennessee is doing a lot. TCU is doing quite a bit, especially on the mound.
I think Mississippi State is worth a mention here because
I did miss that one. Yep.
If you know, what you saw this year from Auburn and A&M is that you can go from the bottom of the SEC to Omaha. And I don't want to just say it was entirely through transfers because it wasn't at either one of those schools. But transfers were a big reason why both of those schools went from Auburn finished a 12th and A&M finished 13th, 14th a year ago in the SEC standings. And then they ended up this year in Omaha. That kind of turnaround, that's what Mississippi State is going for. They were last in the SEC this year. They've gone heavy in the portal. They have a strong recruiting class. They are trying to not necessarily totally flip the roster, but just inject a lot of talent into the roster because, of course, that's not a place where they are used to residing, especially as the reigning national champs.
Yeah, exactly. So, look, and that's just more evidence that, I mean, look at the teams we're talking about here. And there are some mid-majors that really play a lot in this space. But, I mean, we're talking about some of the biggest brands in the sport. We're talking about a lot of power conference programs. That's what this is. So anybody who has kind of hoped or just thought that this thing would kind of, and I think water will find its level eventually. I mean, we talk about some of these situations where, you know, you've got multiple shortstops coming to campus, or, you know, we talked about Reggie Crawford. What would he do at Tennessee if he ends up at Tennessee? So water does find its level because there are sometimes you find out there are good and bad sides of transferring. And so I do think there is a little bit of a fever here that might break a little, but it's certainly not going away. It's always going to be, as long as the rules exist in the way they do now, it is always going to be a big part of building a program. And I just think that's kind of where we are now.
I mean, you wrote about that in Omaha that,
right,
look around. The real exception of just Stanford, who has an academic situation, everyone here in Omaha has transfers playing a significant role.
Yeah. Like where, even on the, you know, even for the teams that weren't doing a ton, like where would Oklahoma have been without Trevin Michael? Right. You know, obviously A&M was playing heavily in it, and Ole Miss had, you know, John Gaddis and Jack Washburn through important innings. You know, so even if the non-obvious teams, I think we're getting a lot from the transfer portal. I think the big difference in this year and last year, and this makes sense, this stands to reason, but the depth of what's in the transfer portal this year is so much better than it was last year. And, you know, last year that makes sense because the one-time transfer exception legislation got passed in late April, or got approved in late April of last year. So that's not a lot of lead time before players at least theoretically needed to be in the portal to be able to take advantage of that. So there was that. I think there was also like a little bit of timidness on the, and I think we talked about this actually in the immediate aftermath of it. I think if you're a player, you were kind of like, well, I could do this, but we haven't seen what the ramifications are going to be like. And then again, you look at, oh, there's transfers all over the place in Omaha and in the postseason and, you know, winning awards, being all Americans. So I think that did kind of open up a lot of players' eyes to, oh, okay, this is maybe not as scary as I thought it was going to be. And so I think all of that has conspired to create a situation where the depth this year is just kind of off the charts, where you look at it and you've got guys who play on the collegiate national team as low as 13 on this list with Jordan Sprinkle, who spent the summer of 2021 there. You know, Ross Dunn at number 10 was on the collegiate national team, the training camp roster. Did he make the final cut?
He's there right now.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, on the collegiate national team right now, at number 10, and you just didn't see that last year. There are a lot of guys who didn't make the top 50 who probably would have been in the 20s, low 30s at bare minimum, on last year's list. It's just, I just incredible year over year, how much more depth there is. And I think there is a certain type of transfer too that you're seeing this year in some places that you didn't see last year. So the most common transfers we saw last year were, I mean, obviously coaching changes can catalyze some of this, but also just, you know, the high-end recruit that flamed out maybe in their first stop that's looking for a new lease, the mid-major player who wants to prove himself at a higher level, that's another one. But you're seeing guys this year, and again, this is where I go back before I use specific examples. players transfer for a million individual reasons more so than one unifying reason. It is a very individual decision that a lot of is based on a lot of information that you or I or anyone else is not really privy to. But you look at some guys this year, like Dylan TeBrock, frankly, you know, a top 10 pitcher putting up really good numbers at Creighton. Like that's Creighton, a good program. That's kind of a player that typically like you would not have expected to go. Even a better example, I would say, you go a little bit further down and at number, I'm scrolling, number 21, you have Zane Denton, who was a starting third baseman in the SEC at Alabama, who is now going to Tennessee. And that in particular, like TeBrock is one thing, like, okay, Creighton is technically a mid-major. Yes, it's a good mid-major. Yes, they have amenities because they get to play in Charles Schwab Field and all of that. But to be a starting position player at a team that went to a regional in 2021, was, you know, pretty good in 2022, and then to transfer to another SEC program is not really something that we saw last year that I think is different about this year. And there are examples kind of up and down this list that are that way, where it's not an obvious, hey, this was a misfit for program and player. Hey, this was a guy who needed more playing time. Hey, this is a guy who's trying to jump up a level. There are just more guys who just for whatever reason that we'll never know, just kind of decided they wanted something a little bit different for a reason that's not blatantly obvious in the way that almost all transfers were last year.
One thing rolling through this list that I am a little bit surprised about is some schools that aren't on the list. And one of them, in fairness to Stankiewicz and the rest of the staff at USC, is that like they just got there. Like the hire was not complete until pretty late. But USC, where's USC? All of their transfers are leaving right now. And I'm a little surprised Clemson isn't on here. And Clemson had a pretty solid roster a year ago. They were close to being a tournament team anyway, but I just might have expected Eric Backich to play a little more heavily in the portal. I don't know if that's a sign of things to come for Clemson. A lot of work that they've done so far, it seems like, has been flipping their recruits rather than recruiting transfers. And, you know, that's fine. They have good recruits. They had good recruits at Michigan. But really all they've done in terms of transfer, at least on this list, is bringing Willie Weiss with them. And I guess I'm just a little surprised that they aren't playing a little heavier. Is there anyone else that you noticed that you're maybe a little surprised about? I guess we could also throw Texas Tech in here, although they have gotten more active lately.
Yeah, I think Clemson's a good one. I had not really thought about that question before you posed it, but Clemson is a good one just because it's USC is. So I agree with you on USC generally, because like they finished last in the Pac-12. It's a coaching change. Like, yeah, got to do something here. But you
it's
can at least
not kinda, the easiest thing to get into, though, like talking about like it's a good school.
Correct. It costs. It is expensive, and it has, you know, some academic standards that aren't going to cut it for everybody. Right. The admissions is not an easy thing to pass, even if you get some favors there. But although I guess I shouldn't say admissions favors at USC, because people might assume that we're little extra favors there. But so like USC at least is tricky. But yeah, Clemson, there's no disrespect, but it's, you know, it's a public school. You know, you figure most of the guys they'd be looking at would be able to get in and would be just fine. So yeah, the fact that they're not doing that, you know, Backich was a fairly slow burn at Michigan, though. I mean, so maybe that's kind of the way he's approaching this. Although I would say that Clemson has a different level of expectation and is kind of rightfully probably getting a little impatient. So that is kind of surprising there. I think related to the USC situation, which also relates to the Grand Canyon situation, is something you and I have talked about offline, is that there were situations where, well, let me put it this way. It is just going to be part of doing business now that when you fire a coach, the entire team is going to go in the transfer portal, like give or take the entire team. And I'm not so sure it's a smart approach to try to do something to save that and get guys back on campus. Like it worked out well for Grand Canyon because Greg Wallace was an obvious candidate. Like, it made sense. And yes, oh, by the way, we're going to hold on to the players that would have otherwise left, most of them anyway. But so that's an edge case, I think. Generally speaking, though, like, I just don't think playing defense against the transfer portal is probably going to be a winning strategy moving forward. I'll be kind of fascinated to see how schools navigate that, because you and I have both gotten information from people that kind of talks about that topic. And it does seem like it's a very open question about how schools will proceed with that, because it's like, let's be honest too, like, from a baseball standpoint, like, that's one thing, but there is also, like, from an administrative standpoint, I do think there is a different pressure on athletic directors when it's a situation where people are looking at your entire team is in the transfer portal. And I think administrators tend to have a different viewpoint on that a little bit sometimes, about like, well, why are all these players leaving? Like, we need to keep them. We can't have this level of turnover. It looks bad. The optics, yada, yada, yada. That's not me using any specific situation, but I could see that. It's a different, whereas a baseball coach might be like, well, you know, I kind of welcome maybe the turnover a little bit. But anyway, I think that's just going to be something fascinating to watch, because I do think you saw in the coaching cycle this year some movement based on trying to play defense against a transfer portal. And I just, this is just Joe's opinion, I don't think that's going to be a winning strategy.
Yeah, I don't think it's much of a long-term strategy. It's a nice short-term strategy if you can pull it off right. But I don't, that should not be your long-term thinking. And that's, to me, what a coaching hire is. And Joe has provided us with the segue here, and so we're going to take it. And that's that Notre Dame made a hire. They hired Sean Stifler from VCU. And I don't mean to put Notre Dame on the spot and make them an example of what we were just talking about, but there is a school that, like, look, Link Jarrett left very late in the cycle. It was late June when he accepted the job at Florida State. Notre Dame took its time. They took about 3 weeks to make the hire, and they feel like they made a good hire. And I think they should feel like they made a good hire. Sean Stifler is a really good coach. He took VCU to Super Regionals in 2015 and had them a win away from Super Regionals this year. They've made regionals in back-to-back seasons, which is no easy feat from the A-10. I think there's a lot to be said for what Sean Stifler is and his resume and all the rest of it. Notre Dame could have acted much more rashly in the moment and done something else, I'm sure. But they also took their time when they hired Link Jarrett. And I saw a lot of people in college baseball. Maybe some of them were Notre Dame fans, maybe some of them were, and I didn't like take the time to click on Twitter profiles or any of the rest of the places I saw this, but like, why is Notre Dame moving so slow and like snail's pace and all the rest of this? And like, I felt that way when they were taking their time to hire Link Jarrett 4 years ago, 3 years ago, whatever that was. But I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt this time, because it worked out so well for them a year or 3 years ago when they hired Link Jarrett. So if this is their process, that's fine. Like, it seems to, it worked real well then. Maybe it landed them another really good coach. Like, I think it can work really well again. So I don't know. I would generally take Notre Dame is somewhat unique. They are selling, I guess not somewhat unique. They're in a different plane than a lot of schools, because the Notre Dame degree is what it is. The school is what it is. Like, it's a very, you are going to Notre Dame for reasons beyond sports in many cases. Like, you're going to Notre Dame because this is a dream school, or because you want that degree, or, you know, whatever. There are reasons that there are a lot of reasons why they draw the students that they draw. So maybe they have less to fear in the portal, but, you know, they, I appreciate the approach that they took and who they landed on these last two times. And yeah, maybe that was slower than you would like it to be, and who knows all of the reasons why that was the case, but the results seem like they should be pretty good.
Yeah, on paper, I think that's about right. I mean, it's a very similar profile to what Link Jarrett was, as at least in terms of his head coaching experience. Jarrett had a more extensive past as an assistant at various places, but you know, Jarrett came from UNC Greensboro and was doing a good job there, and was kind of the type of, it was a type of situation where unless you're really paying attention, you wouldn't know how good UNC Greensboro had gotten under him, because I think it was, you know, typical mid-major type situation where it's like, you know, there were a lot of years they were really good and just didn't win the SoCon tournament, and therefore their season was over. You know, VCU actually has been a little more consistent the last couple of years getting to the postseason, but they've also run into seasons like that. So VCU similarly, because that 2015 Super Regional appearance is, you know, I mean, that's ancient history for a lot of folks, especially, you know, when you talk recruiting and people who are just now picking up college baseball. But, you know, VCU was really good under Sean Stifler. Like, it was kind of the default A-10 preseason pick every year, and that was looking like smarter and smarter money with each passing year. And you know, he was working with some limitations. You know, VCU invested in a big way in the player development side. They have player development facilities that are better than anything else in the A-10, and better than a lot of much bigger, more prominent baseball programs. But they were playing in an old minor league facility that has like all of the negatives of playing in a minor league facility and like none of the positives, which, like, with Durham Bulls Athletic Park for Duke, is that it's like, you know, right in the middle of downtown and is like, has really good amenities and is kind of a community thing. Like, you know, it's my understanding that the Diamond in Richmond is not that. And playing in a league like the A-10 that, frankly, and I've heard this from enough people to know that it's true, like, the A-10 is not just about half committed to baseball. You got a handful of programs that really care. You've got a lot of programs that, not on the coach level, obviously, but on the administrative level, just aren't invested. And that's tough in that league. It's also a really tough geographic league. So in the face of that, he did a really good job and made VCU a consistent winner there. So I don't think that can be undersold. It's a pretty similar, like I said, a pretty similar profile to what Link Jarrett brought to the table. I also think with the timing thing for Notre Dame, they are a program, to your point, that because of who they are, they're probably always just going to want to take their time with it. But also, like, yes, Link Jarrett brought immediate success, and they will take that if it comes. But I think they're also understanding a little bit of the bigger picture here versus just the kind of, let's make sure the 2023 team is as good as it can be. I think they kind of understand that at Notre Dame, you are probably going to have to be a program that sees the forest better than you see the trees, if that makes sense.
One other bit of news I wanted to touch on here, and that is the MEAC and the Northeast Conference on Tuesday, that was yesterday, Tuesday, announced a partnership, a multi-sports partnership, or a sport or partnership that spans multiple sports. Basically, what it means is that the MEAC schools that play baseball and both men's and women's golf are now going to play those sports as affiliate members or associate members in the NEC. So the MEAC, from a baseball perspective, is dead. And the four schools that were playing baseball in the MEAC are now a part of the NEC. And they made this move because you have to have six teams in your conference to get an automatic bid in the NCAA tournament. The MEAC last year applied for a waiver and got one, but the NCAA Division I Baseball Committee made it pretty clear last August that that was a one-off and that they weren't going to be so open to giving them a waiver again. They really only gave them that waiver because one of the reasons that the MEAC dropped to four teams was because, like, if they had five teams, they automatically get a two-year waiver to, you know, get the situation corrected. But when you drop to four, you have to, like, actually apply for the waiver, and they have to listen to your arguments and all the rest of it. And so one of the reasons they gave them this waiver was because North Carolina Central dropped baseball, in part because of what they said were COVID-related budget cuts. So that made the committee a little more sympathetic to them and gave them that waiver, but they were not expecting to get that waiver moving forward. So now their schools still have access to the postseason, and there are only 30 auto bids in baseball. So the bubble in future seasons just got that much more favorable for teams trying to get in as at-large teams.
Bit of a mutually beneficial situation too. The MEAC teams were up against it. They had to figure something out. Also, the Northeast Conference, you know, Bryant headed out to the America East. Mount St. Mary's headed out to the Metro Atlantic. So they didn't have the numbers problem that the MEAC had, but
they were down to seven.
Yeah, they were not kind of getting into the danger zone. So a little mutually beneficial situation there.
And that was seven with a Division II team and Stonehill coming in this year. So right. It would have been six without Stonehill.
Yeah. So, you know, just kind of a mutually beneficial move, gives safe harbor to the MEAC teams, allows the NEC to kind of not sweat having to lose auto bid status or being in a little bit more trouble there. So I think it just makes sense all around.
Yeah. And I think it is a little unfortunate that one of the two HBCU conferences, the SWAC being the other in Division One, now no longer is sponsoring baseball. And therefore you'll have one less HBCU guaranteed to be in the field. You know, that is somewhat unfortunate. It also, though, is not, you know, so some of that's not really anyone's fault. It's just that two of the teams that left the MEAC are now in the SWAC. So, you know, the SWAC has gotten bigger and stronger, and the MEAC is fighting it a little bit. So a little bit unfortunate that there will be less HBCU representation, at least in a guaranteed way, in the NCAA tournament. But the situation in the MEAC was untenable as a conference completely. Like, they need to be looking at expansion. They are looking at expansion because their football auto bid is also, like, they're sitting right on the edge, but they haven't been able to figure out the expansion aspect of it. So this is just where they are right now. And so I'm glad that these four schools were able to find a spot where they can continue to compete for an auto bid. All right, that's going to do it for us today on the Baseball America College Podcast. Reminder, we are in our off-season mode, it being the off-season, so that means once a week you can find us. And you can find us wherever you find your podcasts. Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts. Hit the follow button, the subscribe button, whatever it is on your favorite platform, and we come at you once a week throughout the off-season. You can also find us on Twitter. I'm at Ted Cahill. Joe is at Joe Healy BA. And all of the written work is over at baseballamerica.com, where you can find Joe's transfer list and the BA 500 and all that other wonderful draft content, both previewing the draft and then next week once the draft begins. We'll be back here next week with another edition post-draft to talk about how things went around the college baseball world in relation to the draft. So until then, thank you all for listening. For Joe, I'm Teddy. We'll talk to you next time.